Today is September the 19th, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question a little differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key. My colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the programs available on wbai.org/archive. We're also on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are a little different. In the case of the Apple Watch, the killer app has always been health. Apple announced the new Apple Watch Series 4 with edge-to-edge displays, which are more than 30% bigger than displays on current models. The Series 4 starts at $399 with GPS or $499 with a cellular, and the top-of-the-line units selling for $1499. The Apple Watch Series 3 is still in production, but the lowest starting price at $279. The Watch Series 4 is redesigned. It features fall detection and heart monitoring. The Series 4 is clever enough to sense when you're falling. It works this out from the movement of your arm, which are different when falling to when slipping or doing other similar actions. If you fall and then remain still for a certain time, it will assume that something bad has happened and contact emergency services and send your location to your emergency contacts using the SOS feature. The Apple Watch already had the ability to detect and warn of a prolonged elevated heart rate when not exercising, but its heart monitoring abilities get far more sophisticated with the Series 4 update. Most simply, it will now be able to spot low rates too. Less commonly a problem, but potentially something to look out for. The Series 4 will also look out for irregular heart rhythms, notifying you of a potential atrial fibrillation. Many journalists have touted this to be a major breakthrough, and it is a revolutionary technology. Hey, Omron has released such a product earlier this year with the same features. I think these journalists ought to do a little more research. Apple is positioning the new watch as a more comprehensive health device, able to take an electrocardiogram to detect an irregular heartbeat, as well as detect a user falling down to initiate an emergency call automatically. This may be potentially appealing to older customers. However, the battery life is still 18 hours and then it needs recharging overnight, between 9 p.m. and 7 p.m., perhaps when older people wake up to use the bathroom. Apple kept the same design for three generations in a row. The Series 4 is a redesign of the Apple Watch. The most obvious change is the inclusion of screens which are more than 30% larger. They now are 40 millimeters and 44 millimeters, up from 38 millimeters and 42 millimeters. The new watches are slimmer than the Series 3, which means that despite the larger screens, they have less volume than their predecessors. Straps released with the Series 3 and earlier models are compatible with the Series 4 and vice versa. The Series 4 is available in stainless steel or aluminum. The OR ceramic edition has been dropped. Finally, the speaker has been bumped up. Apple says it's 50% louder now, and the microphone aperture has swapped sides to move it away from the speaker. Hopefully, this will all result in much better call quality. One problem with the Apple Watch is the necessity of charging it at night means people can't use it for sleep tracking. For older people who may fall 20% of the time during those hours, who's to watch over them? A major question being asked is, how accurate are wrist-worn monitoring devices? The Journal of the AMA is a peer-reviewed medical journal published 48 times a year by the American Medical Association. It's called JAMA. It publishes original research, reviews, and editorials covering all aspects of the biomedical sciences. In a recent publication in JAMA was a study on the accuracy of wrist-worn heart rate monitors. Wrist-worn fitness and heart rate monitors are popular. While the accuracy of chest strap electrode-based heart rate monitors have been confirmed, the accuracy of wrist-worn optically-based heart rate monitors is uncertain. Assessment of the monitor's accuracy is important for individuals who use them to guide their physical activity and for doctors to whom these individuals report heart rate readings. The objective of this study was to assess the accuracy of four popular wrist-worn heart rate monitors under conditions of varying physical exertion. This study recruited 50 healthy adults. The mean age was 37. Participants were women, which made up 58% of the study, and 7 participants were Afro-American, which consisted of 14% of the study. Excluded from the study was people who had cardiovascular disease, pacemakers, and treatment with heart rhythm medications. The protocol was approved by the Cleveland Clinic Institutional Review Board. Participants wore standard electrocardiographic chest strap monitors secured tightly to ensure skin contact. Each participant was randomly assigned to wear 2 different wrist-worn heart rate monitors placed tightly above the ulnar styloid. 4 wrist-worn monitors were assessed: Fitbit Charge heart rate monitor, the Apple Watch, Mia Alpha, and the Basis Peak. Heart rate were assessed with the participant on a treadmill, at rest, and at 2 miles per hour, 3 miles per hour, 4 miles per hour, 5 miles per hour, and 6 miles per hour. Participants exercised at each setting for 3 minutes to achieve a steady state. Heart rates were recorded instantaneously at the 3-minute point. After completion of the treadmill protocol, heart rate were recorded at 30, 60, and 90-second recovery. Across all devices, which consisted of 1,773 heart rate values were recorded, 27 data points were not obtained because of inability to complete the treadmill protocol or monitors losing skin contact. Heart rates range from 49 to 200 beats per minute. When compared with electrocardiogram, the heart rate monitors had variable accuracy as assessed by the analysis, showed that variability occurred across the spectrum of mid-range heart rates during exercise, with less variability at the tail ends. The Apple Watch and Mia Fuse had a 95% of difference for within minus 27 to plus 29 beats per minute of the electrocardiogram, while Fitbit Charge heart rate monitor had a 95% value within minus 34 and plus 39 beats per minute. And the corresponding values for the Basis Peak were within minus 39 to plus 33 beats per minute. Body mass index, age, and sex did not influence the monitor accuracy. They found variable accuracy among wrist-worn heart rate monitors. None achieved the accuracy of a chest strap-based monitor. In general, accuracy of wrist-worn monitors were best at rest and diminished with exercise. This study is limited by examination of convenience study of 4 heart rate monitors in young healthy adults exercising on a treadmill. Results should be confirmed with different types of exercise and with other devices. Continuous heart rate assessment, which is currently not feasible with all devices, would enable more detailed comparisons. Electrode-containing chest monitors should be used when accurate heart rate measurement is imperative, while wrist-worn heart rate monitors are often used recreationally to track fitness, the accuracy varies. 2 of the 4 monitors had suboptimal accuracy during moderate exercise. Appropriate validation of these devices in this group is imperative, which means use these heart rate monitors as a guide. Despite incremental improvements, this is a transformational year for iPhone. Internally, those devices boast some incremental improvements over last year's iPhone X. Among them, a new A12 Bionic chip that improves performance across the board while also increasing power usage efficiency, an upgraded dual camera, and, of course, the new XS Max has the 6.5-inch Super Retina HD display, which makes it the largest iPhone screen to date. Beyond the increased screen size of the XS Max, there's really nothing new about these new flagship phones that make an iPhone X owner, well, chomping at the bit to ditch their one-year-old device for the latest and greatest iPhone. This new crop of iPhones is all about adoption and standardizing the iPhone X design. Last week, Apple announced its new iPhone XS, iPhone XS Max, and iPhone XR devices. Apple has lowered the starting price of its iPhone 7 and iPhone 8 models by $100. The iPhone 7, iPhone 7 Plus, iPhone 8, and iPhone 8 Plus now start at $449, $569, $599, and $689 respectively. Apple's new iPhone XS, pronounced XS, has a 5.8-inch screen and starts at $999. The XS Max, the largest iPhone to date and one of the biggest on the market, has a 6.5-inch screen and starts at $1099. This year's three top phones are all more expensive than last year's models. At the same time, Apple has discontinued the iPhone SE, iPhone 6S, iPhone 6S Plus, and iPhone X. It's no surprise that Apple would drop the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. The company typically discontinues older models each year when it launches new ones. It started offering these phones in 2015, and they've since been replaced by the iPhone 7 and iPhone 8 models, both of which Apple still sells. The iPhone X was only launched last November. Notably, the 6S line and the SE were the last iPhone models that had a headphone jack. The newer models sport only Apple's own Lightning connector. Starting with the iPhone 7, launched in late 2016, Apple ditched the headphone jack. This also means that you can no longer buy an iPhone with a headphone jack. You'll still be able to get these phones, but not through any official channels. The least expensive phone in the Apple's lineup now is the iPhone 7, which starts at $450, but that phone has a 4.7-inch screen, compared with a 4-inch one on the SE. Apple also introduced a lower-cost 6.1-inch iPhone XR made of aluminum, starting at $749. The iPhone XS Max display size is 26% larger than the previous largest iPhone display. As for the iPhone X introduced in November, it's notable that Apple would discontinue a product less than a year after its introduction. However, the new iPhone XS, or now pronounced XS, has the same starting price of $999, and it offers better specs overall. As of today, well, here's a new iPhone lineup. And this is not the first time that Apple is selling this many phones at once. It's the iPhone 7, iPhone 7 Plus, iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus, iPhone XS, iPhone XS Max, and iPhone XR. This year, the company has cut the number back down to 7. Today, we think of a clone as being an exact replica or exact functionally working model of an existing piece of equipment. That wasn't the way it was defined back in the early 80s when the IBM PC was first announced. There were many clone systems that were designed similarly to be IBM compatible, but it was compatible in the sense that it used the same processor, but what they did was they improved on the hardware. One of the things that most people were using was Flight Simulator, and the test of a true clone was, does Flight Simulator run on the clone system? And the reason why many of them would not run is because the IBM graphics that they came up with was much better than what was available on the initial introduction of the IBM PC. Today, there's something somewhat similar to that, and it's not Flight Simulator that's being used. Now they're talking about how good an operating system it is, and how you define how good an operating system it is that how well can it run another operating system? And what is a test that some of the people are using to test whether or not an operating system can run another operating system? I'm not talking about a sandbox or a virtual machine, but actually running the code. And what was announced recently was Windows 95 is the operating system that's now used as a yardstick for what's possible on modern devices and platforms. We've seen the Microsoft popular operating system appear on the Apple Watch, Android Wear smartwatch, and even the Xbox One. Today, someone has gone a step further and made Windows 95 into an app that you can run on macOS, Windows, and Linux. Slack developer Felix Riesberg is responsible for this particular application, allowing nostalgia lovers to play around with Windows 95 in an Electron app. Riesberg has published the source code and app installers for this project on GitHub, that's GitHub, and you can download it from there, and apps like WordPad, Phone Dialer, MS Paint, and Minesweeper all run like you expect. However, the one thing it doesn't run is Internet Explorer. It is not fully functional as it simply refuses to load pages. The Windows 95 app that runs on these multiple operating systems uses only 129 megabytes of memory in size, and you can download it over GitHub for both the Mac OS version and Windows. Once it's running, it surprisingly only takes up around 200 megabytes of RAM. Even when running all the old Program 95 utilities, apps, and games. If you run into any issues with the app, you can always reset the Windows 95 instance inside the app and start over again. You may ask, why Windows 95? There's a lot of equipment that's been around that is still quite useful, and the drivers are not available in Windows 10. You know, originally, when a new operating system was introduced, Microsoft would put in things like Windows XP compatibility, then Windows 7 compatibility. I was hoping they'd do the same thing in Windows 10, where you can go back to Windows XP or 7 compatibility. Why would I want that? Today, it's all digital photography, but many of us have taken many pictures in regular film format, and we would like to digitize it. How do you digitize it? With a film scanner. And you could say, well, you could buy one of these film scanners today and just use it. I bought a wonderful film scanner. It was a Nikon film scanner, and it does wonders. It's not available in any of the existing scanners today. The Nikon film scanner had a couple of capabilities in there, such as if you happen to have an overexposed picture or an underexposed picture, it can give you the proper exposure before it does the scanning. Man, it's beautiful. Well, the Nikon scanner was not cheap. Marty is in the midst of replacing an old hard drive with a new solid-state drive. I asked him to give me a how-to segment on his project.
My usual segment on making a more efficient house will come later. You get to hear me twice tonight. But on the subject of getting what you want, can we talk about your notebook PC? Not to be indelicate, but how old is it? If it's more than a few years old, its main drive is probably not an SSD. It's probably an HDD, a hard disk drive, a motor-spun magnetic platter device, and not an SSD, a solid-state drive with no moving parts. Sure, everybody knows that an SSD is a lot faster than a hard drive. An SSD system boots faster, applications load faster. And in a few minutes, I'll give you some info about how to swap an SSD into your system in a way that won't lose you a crumb of data or configuration or anything. But first, let's get into whether you're an online user or an offline user, and what that really does mean. And what that really doesn't mean. And even before that, we should think about whether your PC is or even should be equipped to work both ways, both online and offline. Not as obvious an answer as you may anticipate. Imagine you're a manufacturer and you build notebook PCs and you want to keep the price down. You cut corners on the configuration, you install less memory, you put in a smaller drive, that kind of thing. For somebody who does a lot of multitasking and runs a lot of application, well, all of that eats up memory. And when a PC runs out of physical memory, it starts using virtual memory, which means it's now doing a lot of reading and writing to the disk. Even with an SSD, that's slower than system memory. If your notebook is running slow, a memory boost may help. but you have to be able to look up your model and figure out what kind of memory is in it and in what format and whether there's a capacity cap on how much it can address and whether you can buy a bigger module anywhere on the planet, assuming that your buying is limited to the planet. Even if your notebook is new enough to have an SSD, boosting the memory can still speed it up. Once you figure out exactly what it will take, you can decide whether it's a better bargain to upgrade and rejuvenate your notebook or to replace it. But let's get into that online-offline topic. It comes down to this. How much does it handicap getting your work done if you can't connect to the internet? Are there local copies of your application stored on your notebook? Can you fire them up whether or not you have an internet connection? Congratulations, you have offline accessible applications. Traditional applications, like when you used to be able to buy Office in a Box from a store and install it on your computer, those always gave you that option. Online applications don't always. Office 365 tends to be somewhere in between, depending on how you configure it. Even if the only things you ever do with your notebook involve running Office applications or your web browser, you've just eaten up a sizable chunk of your available drive space. But where's your work? Do you tend to consider it a great convenience to have your work stored in a cloud somewhere so you can log in and get access to it from wherever you happen to be? Really? And where does that leave you if the place you happen to be can't connect to the cloud? And while you're considering your objections to that proposed predicament, consider this. Is there anything in your spreadsheets or your documents that you'd rather keep secret? Anything you'd rather not have other people see? Anything you'd rather not have blocked from your access until you pay a ransom? Those Russian hackers aren't all working on elections, you know. Most of them are in it for more entrepreneurial forms of revenue and personal monetary enrichment. They like to use their skill sets to harvest money. Quick, name a major bank that hasn't had its systems hacked and tons of confidential records stolen, or, for that matter, any major online accessible data trove. Identity theft is one of those revenue sources the hackers love to harvest. I'm a great believer in keeping my work local. I use Dropbox for doing things like getting my radio segments into the hands of program producers. I regularly prune my folders and files on Dropbox and Google Drive and Microsoft OneDrive. I treat them as transfer points, not warehouses or even storage rooms. And something else. I run Windows Defender. It works. Every once in a while, I'll let it do a deep scan. I just did that this month when there was a 3-day weekend. It scanned, something like 22 million files. Want to guess how many threats were in those files? A grand total of zero. You know, Windows Defender used to cost $50 a year, and I was glad to pay it. Then Microsoft made it free. I asked Microsoft why. Hey, weren't they leaving a lot of money on the table? As it turns out, it saved them more money than it could have made them. Know why? It cut way down on the number of incoming support calls that had been triggered by malware issues. They nip those in the bud. I'm not bashful about recommending Windows Defender to everyone, especially now that it's free, and especially since I've seen for myself how many attempts at getting into my system it detects and thwarts. Now, let's get back to your notebook. I just laid out for you why I like to keep my applications and my work on my own drive, not in the cloud. And if you haven't been doing that but want to now, you may want to think about a bigger drive. Bigger SSDs tend to come with some sizable price tags. Include that in your thinking. Now, when your notebook was built, 2 terabyte, 1 terabyte, even 0.5 terabyte hard disk drives were modest cost items. How big is your drive? How much free space is left? Here's what I'm getting at. It's like a repair or replace decision for a car. How much life is left in your old notebook? What would it cost to rejuvenate it? And what would it cost to replace it? And what would a replacement have that you don't have now? After all, things like Thunderbolt 3 ports are a fairly recent phenomenon. So, let's say you decide, yes, you want to upgrade your notebook by swapping its old hard disk drive for a new SSD. What do you do first? The answer is homework. Hit a search engine to find and download the maintenance manual for your specific notebook model. You may want to also copy that file to one of the cloud drives you can access from a tablet or smartphone because you'll almost assuredly want to look at it again when your notebook is down. Speaking of your smartphone, it has another set of jobs to do. Start by snapping photos of the stickers on the bottom of your notebook or inside the battery compartment. While we're thinking photography, also take a snapshot of the system choice under Control Panel's System and Security category. Shoot the few lines under System on its display. Then pull up Windows Explorer, right-click on your main drive, the one you boot from, and take a picture of the General tab, showing you the drive capacity, used space, and free space, plus its file system, which should be NTFS. A little more homework. Search for online postings about upgrading your notebook model. Take note of any advice about the best way to approach disassembling it so you can swap memory or drives, and especially look for anybody complaining if that particular model has its hard drive or its memory permanently soldered in. That's a forget-it point, because desoldering and resoldering, well, those take skills and equipment beyond what most do-it-yourselfers possess. Also, double-check the power requirements of your new drive versus the old one. Make sure the notebook can support it. And make very sure you know how to get to your notebook's setup screens. When you first boot it up, there's usually an on-screen message to push some named key, sometimes the delete key, sometimes one of the function keys, to enter its setup interface. Old-timers will call it the BIOS interface, BIOS, short for Basic Input-Output System. That was the original incarnation of access to the computer's underlying firmware settings. That's been expanded and enhanced and became something called UEFI. Most people don't know that UEFI stands for Unified Extensible Firmware Interface. So don't sweat remembering all those syllables. Just remember UEFI and setup. It gets critically important in a minute. Okay, you've done your homework. You have the manual. You know that your model notebook doesn't have its drive and memory soldered in. You're ready to order your new SSD. Is there anything else you'll need? Oh, yeah. How will you connect the new drive to prepare it before you install it? I use a USB dock. They're not very expensive. A USB dock that can hold a SATA drive. Make that a USB 3 dock, where you have a 5 gigabit per second bandwidth. One example is the Aluratech AHDDU200F. It has one bay that can hold any 2.5-inch or 3.5-inch SATA drive. And before this is over, I'll tell you a great application for that bay after, that dock, rather, after the transfer. You may see similar two-bay docks that have a one-button data transfer feature. Do not use one of those. Those are for cloning identical drive types. They'll mess up an HDD to SSD transfer. Get a single SATA bay USB 3 dock. And there's something else you'll need. You can't just copy everything from the old drive to the new one, because it won't be everything. You'll want to use some specialized software that can make a clone, a bit image of the original drive, something that includes all the registry settings, all the hidden and system files and folders that you normally never see, all the security attributes, all the partitions, everything. I know a couple of utilities that can do that. One is called Drive Image from laplink.com. Drive Image, it's perfect for this kind of transfer. Or if you're up to it, there's a more complex, more sophisticated utility called Casper from Future Systems Solutions, FSSDEV.net. Casper gives you an amazingly convenient daily use for both your old drive and that USB dock, and I'll get into that in a couple minutes. So, okay, you've done your homework, you've gathered all the hardware and software you'll need, and you're all set, right? No way, are you new here? The first thing you do is to make a fresh, full backup of absolutely everything. Put that in a safe place. You might think that you could just clone your old HDD to the new SSD now, swap the drives, and everything will just work. Sorry, chances are it won't boot. UEFI is why. There's a security measure in UEFI that's designed to block malware like rootkits from getting into a computer's boot files. It's an embedded Microsoft certificate. Think of it as a fingerprint. If the UEFI secure boot option doesn't see that same drive, it won't boot. But you have a way to blindfold it. Before you start the cloning and after you've made your backup, reboot your notebook and get into its setup screens. I mentioned those. The screen you want will probably be called something like Boot Options, and somewhere on that screen, you should see an option to disable Secure Boot. Do that. Disable it. Boot back up. Connect your dock and put the new SSD into it. Run the cloning software. It will take a while. When it's done, turn off your notebook. Unplug it from the power line. Remove its battery. Open it up. Slide the old drive out of its socket. Slide the new SSD in. Ditto for any memory upgrade, paying attention to which side is up. Close it back up again, making sure there's no leftover hardware. Put the battery back in. Plug that back into the wall and boot your notebook. With your SSD running as a clone of your old drive, your notebook should just boot right up and do it faster. But if it doesn't, no sweat. Put the original drive back and find somebody to help. At least you'll have all the pieces. Once it's booting successfully, ideally from the SSD, but maybe from the old drive, boot it again and get into the setup mode again to re-enable the secure boot protection. If the SSD won't boot with secure boot turned on, go back to the original drive and seek help. Just remember, before you open the case again for any reason, unplug the power and remove the battery before the only option you're left with is replacing the whole notebook. But let's say everything works. Now, here's a nice surprise. Once the notebook boots from the new SSD, don't get rid of the original drive. Instead, put it in the SATA dock and have another look at Casper. You can configure it to do something better than most backups. It can do what you might call an asynchronous mirror. Every night or every few days, connect the dock with the old drive still in it via USB, then run Casper to update that bit image with everything that's changed on the notebook's new drive. Casper is smart enough to only update the changes. It doesn't need to do the full image copy, so it doesn't take very long. And that means if anything ever happens to the SSD in the notebook, you can swap the original drive back in. It will boot, and it will not have lost any of your work except the little bit you might have done since the last Casper run. And you will have backed up every partition, every hidden or system file, every registry value, and all of your programs and files. Of course, it will also feel like you've backed up into a time zone where everything runs very slowly again, like before. But even if it slows you down, it won't stop you. And you can always run Casper again to clone your old drive back into the SSD. How are you backing up now? How much can you restore? How completely can you restore it? And how many passes with how many approaches will you have to take? You can set all of this to run automatically with the approach I just described. And dare I mention it, it's whole bunches safer and more secure than any of those online backups. Which means it's time for me to get you to go back up. To Hank.
Thank you, Marty. We are regularly bombarded with blockbuster deals, super coupon deals, overstock markdowns, hottest deals, deal of the day, clickbuster deals, and probably many more adjectives for products sold online. Soon we will be receiving in our email must-have items available with pre-Black Friday specials, and then followed by actual Black Friday specials. Of course, this is also followed by Cyber Monday specials. How does one know what is the true discount of a sales item? The product may actually be more expensive than the regular sale price. Before buying anything online, there are two tools that you can use to make sure you're getting a good deal. Thankfully, there are tried and true ways to ensure that you're getting a good deal. Well, let's talk about the two that I'm referring to. Using a price tracking tool like Camel, that's one word, CAMEL.com, and trying a user review analyzer like FakeSpot. The first two is pretty straightforward. CamelCamelCamel.com is one of many product price trackers floating around the web, but it has been popular and reliable for the better part of a decade. To use it, simply copy and paste the URL of whatever item you're considering into the search bar at the top. The tool will then bring up a chart of how that item's price has fluctuated over time. You can just key in the product name and it will display a list of vendors offering the product at various prices. If you were to click on the first selection, the website displays a chart of the purchase price from product inception to the current date. I just looked at the purchase price for the past 6 months or since the beginning of the year. It came as no surprise that purchase price for many of the electronic items have been raised just after Labor Day. I anticipate the prices will drop back down to July-August special prices for Black Friday. Hey, that's called Marketing 101. FakeSpot offers a new way of filtering product reviews, allowing you to find what actual people are saying about the products. The proprietary technology analyzes millions of reviews and finds suspicion patterns and discrepancies. It will then take out the reviews that seem too good to be true so you can make an unbiased, reliable purchase. All you need is a URL of the product in question, which you copy and paste into the site. FakeSpot, that's FakeSpot.com, will then scan and analyze information from both the review itself and the person who created the review. FakeSpot will then give it a grade ranging from A to F. A means that 90 to 100% of the reviews and reviews are reliable, and F means only 44% or less of the information is reliable. It will also give you company grade, which takes the average of all product reviews. When analyzing product reviews, FakeSpot takes a look at certain credentials from the reviewer and the review itself. From the reviewer, it looks to see if it's a verified purchase and if the dates and contents correlate. It also takes into account frequency and purchase dates, as well as various purchasing patterns. On the review front, it analyzes the writing style, grammar, and spelling correlation, and looks to see whether the dates and content correlate. So, get yourself ready. Black Friday will be soon upon us. Don't be surprised if by Halloween, you're going to get all these specials talking about pre-Black Friday. But if you look at Camel, 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 it gives you a pretty good idea of the product you may be looking at on what that pattern is on pricing. I did that recently on a camera. I found that the original selling price was $650. It's a six-year-old product. It's still a very viable product. And although it's 6 years old, it gives me a good idea of what the pattern is. The going price is $448. And when they have a special, they drop it down to $368. And they have a super special. I got it for $278. Yep. I priced it right.
Total cost of operation. Will paying more up front save you in the long run? It's homework. It's not rocket science.
I'll be talking about a concept. You may have heard of it, but may not have understood it, or had a chance to wrestle with it, at least not until now. To the insiders who are familiar with it, its nickname is TCO. That stands for total cost of operation, or total cost of ownership. Don't get too hung up on remembering that. Before we're done, you'll have a very pragmatic sense of it. Here's a really simple explanation. Things cost more than the price you initially pay to buy them. It costs money to run them. There may be things that wear out, so you need to keep buying replacements. There may be a need for service or repairs every so often. And you may reach the end of the useful life of the thing and have to buy a new one. Think of cars. You pay to buy one. You pay to insure it. You may have to pay to garage it at home or park it at work or both. It needs gas all the time. It sometimes needs oil or tune-ups or tires or filters or a new battery or other things that wear out. You may blow an engine or transmission or starter or alternator or need new shocks or springs. And eventually you'll want to replace it with a new car. That's a lot more cost than the initial purchase price. And those are the kinds of factors that bring TCO into the calculation. It comes back to one of the cornerstones of my design project, making a house 40 years maintenance-free, meaning no major repairs or replacements for 40 years. Make no mistake, you pay more upfront to make that happen. The idea is that you'll save in the long run. And there we have the essence of what total cost of ownership is really about. is there enough payback in the long run to make the initial extra cost worth spending? It's a balance sheet. It's part decision, part forecast, part guesswork. For example, will the spending power of today's dollar increase or decrease over the next decade, or two, or three, or four? Will the biggest savings come after the 35th year, and will this still be your house then? Come on, you guys have technical backgrounds, technical interests, so you're not uncomfortable with the math. Look at it this way. Imagine you win a minor lottery and you need a new HVAC system. You can pick a barely get-by system for $15,000, or you can get a last almost forever system for $60,000. Which should you buy? And the first number that goes into our equation will surprise you, but only for a few seconds. It's your age. Let's say that the cheap $15,000 system will have $2,000 maintenance costs every 4 years and need a wholesale replacement every 8 years. That's $10,000 in maintenance costs and $75,000 in replacement costs over 40 years, bringing your total cost to $100,000. Keep these numbers in mind. In this example, the 40-year total cost of ownership for a $15,000 Cheapskate Special turns out to cost $100,000, more than half again as much as the last forever system would have cost you for $60,000 up front, all assuming you have that much cash on hand up front. I keep thinking CCC, my own jargon, for cash corrupts calculations. Cash corrupts calculations. This makes it seem like spending the extra upfront is worth it, but that depends somewhat on your self-control. If you tend to be distracted by shiny things and want to own them, committing to spend bigger money upfront is a one-and-done deal, and once spent, that money won't be there for you to fritter away on frivolities. It would be a good choice for this kind of personality. But if you're really good at husbanding your resources, it's less of a good choice. Remember, the upfront difference in cost is $45,000. Stick that $45,000 into some kind of interest-bearing instrument with an assured annual yield of 2% or so, and in 40 years it will be worth more than $100,000. But again, the math isn't that simple. On the other side of the argument, if the better system saves you $100 a month in energy bills by being more efficient, that's a consideration that over 40 years, 480 months, is worth $48,000. When it comes to calculations like these, I have a helpful mnemonic based on a brand you may recognize or maybe not. Something over half the listeners here are men, so this brand name may not be something you encounter every day, but again, you've probably heard of it. So I'll mention it as a useful mnemonic memory trick. Max Factor Makeup. Yeah, max factor makeup. Meaning that when it comes to the math behind determining a total cost of ownership in operation, until you're dealing with a maximized set of factors, you're not ready to make up your mind. Max factor makeup. Max the factors before you make up your mind. And your age, as I hinted a minute ago, is part of that decision-making process. Let's talk about your house. If you haven't yet hit your 50s and you need a new house now, and your finances aren't going to get disrupted by those tunnels of tuitions for the kids, it's not a bad time to consider putting a little more into the big things you have to buy now to help avoiding getting socked with all those cash vampire costs later. You should, of course, also be thinking about how your needs and circumstances have changed. Can you be happy in something smaller? Do you need a smaller or bigger yard? All that stuff. If you're older, past your 50s, it gets more complicated. Not to be morbid, but how many years do you have left? If you're in your 80s or 90s, it's not a good time to make an investment that takes 40 years to fully pay off, which isn't to say you should abandon thinking in terms of the total cost of ownership, just that you'll want to keep it on a shorter timeline. Yeah, there are plenty of other variations you can fiddle with. No way I can deal with all of that here, but on any timeline, there's a process that I go through in making my decisions about choices that can go for a long time without needing major maintenance, repair, or replacement. And it starts, I'm sorry, with a daunting amount of homework. Whatever the subject, HVAC or plumbing or whatever, the most critical thing to understand is what, in the real world, What most commonly makes it fail? You can learn a lot about that by talking to the guys who do the service calls. Sometimes the factory service guys are reluctant to talk, sometimes not. But the independents are great resources. When you learn from them the specifics of what's likely to fail, for example, in HVAC systems, it's a condenser and evaporator coils. When you find out what's likely to fail, you can also ask if they know of something better, some choice you can make or some element you can substitute to eliminate that source of failure. And when you know that, go to the second most likely point of failure and the third. You point blank ask them, if I want this to be completely problem free with no service calls for one or two or three or four decades, how do I pull together what I need to make that happen? I've been talking about some of the infrastructure, but that's also true of the structure. A raised metal roof will outlast a shingle roof. Engineered wood will outlast natural timber. PEX piping will perform better than plastic or metal pipes. High-density foam will outlast other forms of in-wall or floor or ceiling insulation. Well, wait, that's not quite true. It's more accurate to say that it will be effective as an insulator longer than other forms. The other kinds of insulation are unlikely to go away, but they will tend to become less effective over time as insulators. All of these elements are costlier than what builders put into most houses, and you should know that they may or may not enhance a home's resale price. Tell you what, for right now, let's stick with the things that go into a new build, and next time, I'll get into a way to retrofit an existing house, some baby steps, some bigger ones, to help their longevity and energy economy. For this next part, try to think at least two-dimensionally, not just linearly. I've been talking about the elements of my design that make a house 40 years maintenance-free, not so much about being energy miserly, but there's a lot of overlap. It's probably easiest to understand in the HVAC system. The better insulated the house, the less the HVAC system has to force corrective adjustments. In hot weather, if the heating of the outside of the house gets blocked and never makes it to the inside of the house, the indoor temperature will rise very little, if at all. In practical terms, you're unlikely to have things so well insulated that it never turns on, but it's not at all unlikely to have a house where the HVAC runs less. And when it does run, doesn't run for so long a time. And yes, it works the same way when it's really cold out and you want the house to stay warm. The less work there is for an HVAC system to do, the less wear and tear it encounters, and the longer it can go without needing major service. I think that bears repeating. The less work the HVAC system has to do, the less wear and tear it's going to encounter, and the longer it can go without needing major service. So, here we go. These are the starting points for a more efficient build. It starts with a high-density foam like foamsulate. That's something I'd better spell for you, F-O-A-M-S-U-L-A-T-E. Foamsulate's a high-density foam you blow into the ceiling of the attic, which helps isolate it from what's above the roof. In the basement or foundation, build it using ICF, insulated concrete forms. Those jacket the concrete with, again, foam, which is used all over the place in construction, to thermally isolate things. In this case, it isolates the foundation from the surrounding soil. SIP walls, S-I-P, structural insulated panels. That's an Oreo sandwich of high-strength engineered wood panels with a permanent filling of high-density foam, the best way to separate indoor from outdoor climates for the whole house. High-quality thermal windows, customized for the directions they face. Roof eaves that are 5 to 15 inches longer than standard for the additional shade on windows and walls and additional separation for any overflow of precipitation, including melting snow, falling rain, whatever. PEX, P-E-X plumbing for the pipes. If you have gas service available, opt for natural gas over electricity every time you make an appliance choice. All LED lighting, best if done through fixtures. LED lighting, well, alternatives generate at least 3 to 5 times as much heat. Round ventilation ducts, not rectangular, for more efficient delivery and less back pressure. Back pressure can destroy an HVAC system. Large duct register vents for the same reason. Conditioned water to prevent lime buildup from driving plumbing fixtures into early retirement. Tankless water heaters. One more thing. Much as being energy miserly impacts being long-term maintenance-free, a sensor-rich cybernetic environment also plays a role. With motorized dampers in the vent lines and awareness of when rooms are vacant and out of use, we again reduce the wear and tear on the HVAC system. If automation is better than people about turning off the lights, we lose that small bit of unproductive heat. And everything we do to detect inappropriate vibrations or temperatures or humidity levels or light penetration lets us catch problems when they're little and cheap to fix. That, in fact, all of this, is very much like the way you work with your computer, or should. First, you find out what can fail. Then you find ways to prevent that failure. What can fail with computers? Well, disks can, and you lose all your work and all your photos and everything. Power can, and that can cost you a disk with everything on it. Almost anything can. Unless you back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a meeting on Thursday, September the 20th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and this is not the normal meeting date, but it got moved to Thursday, September the 20th, and the presentation is GNU Cache, GNU, not Unix. Meeting will be held at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, in Manhattan, New York. Princeton PC Users Group has a meeting on Tuesday, September the 25th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. in the Community Room in Princeton Public Library, located at 65 Witherspoon Street in Princeton, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer User Group will have a presentation by Dr. Alfred Poor, my colleague. Topic is Healthy Worker, Happy Company, the Growing Role of Employee Health Monitoring. Meeting is on Thursday, September the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. at the Middletown Library Computer Lab in Middletown Township Public Library, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing, New Jersey. They have a presentation on the really smart way to buy a printer. They meet on Tuesday, October the 2nd, at 1:30 p.m., and they meet at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has a meeting on Tuesday, October the 2nd. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. at 24 Hospital Avenue in Danbury, Connecticut. Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation on Premier Elements 2018. They meet on Thursday, October the 4th. The meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, October the 5th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will meet Friday, October the 12th at 7 p.m., and they'll meet at the Harry J. Schur Hall, New York Institute of Technology, located at Old Westbury Campus, Old Westbury, New York. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access session at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb computer question. And we hope to see you at these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, it's essential you back up. Just remember, three things you have to do: backup, backup, and backup. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.